Court Judge Elizabeth
Schroeder asked the defendant to declare in his trial.
I'm not asking for
the
trial. So you're not asking for
jury selection in the death penalty trial is supposed to last 2 months before the actual trial begins at the end of May. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
We're the one who protects the flock, and that requires an eye for detail. Because when safety and well-being are on the line, it's the details that can save lives. Even when no one else is watching, you see everything. Granger's with you, and we're here for you, and all the ones who get it done with a wide range of safety products and solutions. Plus, board-certified safety consultants here to answer your questions. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like you're going 100 miles an hour, barely keeping up. But to cruise through challenges, you need someone who's right there with you. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the Windows PCs and tech advice you need to get past whatever's in front of you and get where you want to go. Call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. A start to a simpler experience with Windows 11 Pro.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Vasily and Transformation Talk Radio.
Had enough of the been there, done that ideas? Tired of too much talk and so little action? Rewind now and welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Obear, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers with dynamic, engaging conversation and the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelt and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Kathy Obear with the Center for Transformation and Change. So excited to be back with my friend and colleague, Dr. Becky Martinez. As we continue, this might be our fourth or fifth conversation about dynamics of class and classism, and what can we do inside organizations and maybe as we are working in communities to recognize, raise awareness, begin to dismantle, and just shift interpersonal, but particularly policies and practices. And Becky, I just am so excited to keep learning with you and our wonderful guests.
Yes. So Again, thank you, Kath, for asking me to be a part of this. I continue to learn with each show and in between each show. And I am excited to be here with my dear friend and colleague and, like, partner in this work, Dr. Sanja Ardwan. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You're close.
No.
You're close.
No, but I want to be at it.
Yes. I say my last name, Ardwan.
Ardwan. There we go. See, all this time together, and what I appreciate about Sanja's work and who she is in the world is she writes from the soul and her like brain. We can talk about capitalism and all those other things, and she just. Like, she talks about class in real ways and intersecting ways and shows up authentic and can put out journals and books like nobody's that I know. And so we're so glad to have you here today, Sanja. So you can introduce yourself a little bit, and I think the question that we'll open with after your introduction is tell us a little bit about your class story.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kathy and Becky, for having me. Hi, everybody. My name is Sanja Ardwin. I use she, her pronouns. I am proudly from the tiny community of V Dream, Louisiana, which you likely will not find on a map. It does not have a zip code, nor does it have a red light, but it is where I am from and still call home, even though I haven't lived there in a while. I am a first-generation college student who went to a K-12 high school, so that was a shift for me and being able to pursue higher education was a goal and sort of dream of mine as well as my family's, and I've been very privileged to earn degrees from LSU, Florida State, and NC State, and worked as a student affairs primarily practitioner for about 10 years before shifting over to faculty, and I've been in a faculty role teaching and learning and thinking and doing higher ed and student affairs work for about 7 years. On this side of the house, the more primarily practitioners or scholar side, but I do sort of identify as a scholar practitioner or pracademic and really strive to blend that sort of theory and practice, scholarship and practice, those sorts of things. So that's a little bit about what I do. In terms of my class story, so I mentioned I grew up in Beijing, Louisiana. It is part of Evangeline Parish because we have parishes in Louisiana, not counties. Because we are still under a Napoleonic Code, the Code of Law, so that's a fun fact for y'all. But the parish I'm from is one of the poorest parishes or counties in the United States, and so that was sort of the context in which I grew up. Not a lot of folks went to college, and so therefore I thought you went to college for three things, doctor, teacher, lawyer, because everybody I knew who went to college was in one of those roles. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean everybody in the parish or in my town grew up poor or working class. And some of them did based on some of their sort of capital dynamics in terms of social capital, cultural capital, financial capital. Other folks had financial capital from owning their own business or working offshore, or when farm work does well or there's good subsidies, those sorts of stuff. There can be some financial components to that and financial success, but there might be some other parts that still had them sort of straddle class in different ways. All four of my grandparents worked on the farm. And so varying crops. My parents had different, what I would call blue-collar jobs. My dad was a truck driver for a while, and the majority of my time as a child, he worked at a lumberyard as an assistant manager at the local lumberyard. And so therefore, I was also employed by age 10, writing the bills for that lumberyard by hand because he said I had better handwriting than him. And so he paid me a couple of bucks to write the bills every month for the lumberyard. And then my mom had some administrative assistant positions at some places, the local Creso pole company, if you know what that is. And then when that shut down, she went to a medical office, and then she spent most of my childhood working at a gas station / specialty meats grocery store. So shout out to Teach Grocery in Ville Platte. They have the best specialty smoked meats you will ever eat. So a little PSA there. And so I grew up in a family that you worked different hours, long hours, sometimes sun up to sun down, sometimes third, like second shift. My mom worked a lot of late nights at the gas station grocery store to having multiple jobs, but also being engaged in your community. My grandparents are very engaged in their community, really from a collectivism standpoint and sharing crops with other people from the garden and being engaged, like playing cards with people at their house, going visiting, that's what they would call it, I'm going to go visit. And then my dad was a volunteer firefighter. My mom volunteered at our local Catholic church. And so there was this piece of you also, even though you work hard and you work long hours, you also give back to your community in sort of a collectivist way as well. So I learned a lot of good stuff from that, and I learned a lot of bad habits from that as well.
Learning all kinds of things in these last few minutes. Oh my goodness. But I appreciate the share, right? So even for me, I'm like, oh, new information. And the late night, right, double shift and community piece. And, you know, even as we think about time and, you know, time is a valuable commodity, or valuable something, being able to, even in all of the exhaustion, which I'm sure they were, still supporting community and who they are and what they could do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because now sometimes I'll talk to my parents and, you know, I'll say, oh, I'm, you know, evaluating student assignments or, you know, I'm doing this or I'm going on this work trip. And my mom was like, you work too much. And, like, in my mind, I'm like, who do you think I learned that from? You know, I learned that from y'all. And so, and I think what I struggle with from, like, a class traveling perspective on that is that I don't view my work as hard because it is not physically laborious, right? Like, I'm not carrying pieces of wood, and I'm not, my mom used to have to carry really heavy boxes, like, to restock the grocery store, right? And so I'm not necessarily physically tired, and my work is not physically laborious, and so I view it as, well, it's not that hard. Of course I can do it for longer because it's not that hard.
Yeah. And we may come back to exhaustion, burnout, especially with folks. Well, I'm excited to learn with you on a number of reasons, and particularly you're focused on first-generation, poor, working-class, rural students. And I didn't know how cross-race your community was. But one reason I'm excited to talk is when we talk classism, I think particularly white folks think folk of color, indigenous folks, we've intersected poor, and I think that's part of racism.
Yes.
What I was hoping you would also talk about was the invisibility of white poor, particularly first gen, and in organizations and hiring and higher ed. So what do you think? And I'm not saying either or, but I just think there's an invisibility, just like your town wasn't on the map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And much less the stereotypes of poor, white, working class folk in rural areas. So I know that's like 10 questions in there, but that's yeah. Like, I want to learn so much with you today.
Yeah, I think I'm following though, Gabby. I think, so to speak to sort of racial dynamics of where I'm from, it is folks who identify as black, folks who identify as white, and then folks who would identify as biracial, multiracial, and or Creole. And so Cajun and Creole are sort of components. So Cajun, I would say, is sort of more of an ethnic group, and that occurs across race. Most folks who identify as Creole, most of those people would identify as people of color, and so there is both an ethnic component and a racial component to that as well. So some folks, if you met them in my hometown, wouldn't say they're biracial or multiracial, they would say I'm Creole, and so that is sort of how they're defining that. But outside of sort of black, white, and folks who are bi or multiracial or Creole, there weren't a lot of other folks who identified in different ways. So we had a couple of folks we went to high school with, like I could probably name them on one hand, who identified as indigenous or with different native communities that were sort of in the, you know, general area where we lived in Louisiana, because there are the Coushatta tribe and one other tribe that are in that area. And so thinking about what did that mean? And so often it was interesting as a kid, and I don't know that I could have named this as a kid, but the sort of how race and class mixed together. And because my family talked about both in different ways, sometimes in coded ways, sometimes in direct ways. But I always sort of knew that being white got me different opportunities in my community and at my school, even though I came from more of a working class background, right? So I knew there was a distinction around class based on how I felt that. But then it was also clear to me there was a distinction around race based on sort of some of the practices, racist practices, if we're going to be clear about that, that happened in my high school. A lot of the young black men in my school got tracked into special ed, and then they basically had PE all day, and then they were on our basketball team, and we were really good. And so there were interesting dynamics to some of those things. We had earlier in my time as a child, there were two homecoming queens, right? There was a black homecoming queen and a white homecoming queen. And that, so there was a racial piece there, but there was also a class piece there, because often folks who are from families like mine weren't on homecoming court, right? Like, we couldn't have afforded it. We wouldn't have been voted that way because of some of the class dynamics that showed up. So it was, and how people, where people live, even though it's a rural community, who owns land, who has the ability to sell land, who are they selling that land to or not to, based on some of the, both the race and class dynamics there. So I think it showed up in all kinds of ways and was less hidden. And then it was interesting because later in life I moved to Boston, and people think Boston is like this extraordinarily racially diverse city, which it is if you look at the numbers, right? But then if you start to look at neighborhoods and where people live and how people are coded, like, oh, you live in that neighborhood, this must mean this about you, related to both race and class dynamics. And when I was in college, there was some of that as well, because I went to LSU, and a lot of the folks, not a lot, more of them were from cities than from rural areas. And if you are from the city of New Orleans or any of that surrounding area, the first question is always, where did you go to high school? Even if you've earned multiple college degrees and like those sorts of things, they are sort of coding you based on the name of your high school. So that didn't bode well for me as a college student, because nobody knew me during high school, right? And so so again, to the invisibility point you're talking about there is who is known and who is not known and why, I think are some important components to think about I think the other piece of what you're saying, you know, first gen and rural and working class, the other piece, I think, when we think about sort of poverty and white folks, is also around region, right? I think there's a different narrative around poor southern white folks than there would be about, you know, poor white folks in Montana or, you know, in Vermont or, you know, other parts of the country that are, noticeably whiter. And particularly because I think in the South as well, we often associate poverty, we conflate poverty and race in some respects. And for some people that's true, the combination is true. And for some people it is not, because rurality is not just white. Go to rural Mississippi, right? Go to rural Texas, go to rural California, you know, places in rural North Carolina that are predominantly people of color who are in rural spaces. And so thinking about some of those things too, I think has been interesting in my life, but then also from a research perspective and some of the work we're trying to do around rurality.
I mean, even when we think class, right, or we think poor, we don't often, like, we go to poor urban. Mm-hmm. Right. And like rural isn't even part of the subject matter or thinking or engaging. And so I know that, you know, given your story and given your research and given your like passion and need, talk a little bit about what would be some ways that we could uplift having conversations around the intersection of rural and poor.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people have said, well, there's not a lot of people there, so it's not a big issue. But if you look across the country, right, more of it is rural than urban. And so thinking about what does that sort of mean and look like, and I think to not make the assumption that rural people never leave rural communities. Some of them want to go back. I think that's the other challenge, too, is that there's a – same way there's like an upward mobility bias around social class in sort of higher ed spaces, I think there is a you got out mentality around rural spaces that people make the assumption people don't want to go back or they question why people do it. Excuse me. And so thinking about, and we don't tell people what it means that they might not be able to. So like, I don't think anybody ever said to me, hey, guess what? If you get these certain degrees or whatever, it's going to be really hard for you to ever go home. Like, nobody ever said that to me. They just made the assumption that I didn't want to. And so there never was never sort of a recognition or realization of what you're giving up. And in some ways, I've been able to recreate that. Now I do live sort of in a what I would consider a rural town. That's the other, I think, complicated factors. Who we're asking to define rural, what measures we're using, are they quantitative or qualitative, like all of those pieces. But my thing is, and some of the rural sociology research supports this, is it's a know it when you see it concept. So I'm always like, come to Dallas, North Carolina, and tell me it's not rural, right? And so I think that that's part of the complicating factor, too. I was at an event a couple of weeks talking to some educators and legislators in North Carolina, and one of the things I sort of called to question was how the UNC system is defining rural, because it's a SES metric. It's actually not a rural metric. And so then some places that get skewed, right? So the county where Appalachian State, where I work, is in Watauga County. Well, there are two affluent cities in that county. One is Boone, where App State is. The other is Blowing Rock, which is more of a sort of retirement, vacation-y type of community. Well, their SES skews the rest of the county. And so even though the county is rural, it's not being served by some of these policies and practices related to rurality because they're using conflated metrics. And we can point that out on the federal level. We can point that out on lots of levels. I think higher ed institutions are paying more attention. There are more positions that we're seeing in sort of enrollment management and admissions offices that are to recruit rural students, and that even at places that are really urban. So WashU in St. Louis is one of those institutions that is hiring somebody specifically focused on rural communities and areas. Now, that's more so probably from a business imperative than a moral imperative. But regardless, right, I think sometimes those business imperatives are what get people to pay attention. And so I think the 2016 election made people pay more attention to rural America, but also made them made sort of a narrative that rural America is white, which is, again, it's not a monolithic, rurality is not monolithic. And I think how do we complicate that narrative around rurality, just like we're trying to complicate the narrative around social class and what that means and looks like. So I think about a lot of those things when I think about rurality. And I think about, you know, there's similar challenges, like the local high school near where I live there was a gun issue at the high school recently. And so people sometimes think, well, that doesn't happen in rural areas. Yes, it does, right? Like there's significant addiction challenges in rural areas. And so how are we sort of paying attention and providing resources to those folks as well? Because if we want to create a sort of civically engaged populace, giving folks access to learning, whether or not that's higher ed, right? That might be some other apprenticeship, like some other form of learning, but giving people access to that, I think, is really important.
You know, as I hear you, Sandra, I love it. And the stereotypes that I grew up with about folks who are poor, maybe working class, was a little less derogatory. So I'm having wonders about, we can have a position at a university that says we want to recruit, and just like we did similar with students of color across class, the retention. So what I'm wondering is, how do we prepare staff, faculty, and if people are listening, and you might be K-12, you might be in nonprofits, you might be in corporations, how do we prepare folks to understand the biases, stereotypes, to interrupt it? And then there might be some policies and practices that are just set up to continue to privilege folks from middle-class backgrounds, if not upper-middle-class. So, again, 5 or 6 questions, but I'm curious because I don't think we're prepared in higher ed K-12 to support folks from rural areas across race, particularly poor and working class, but I could be wrong.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I think that, you know, sometimes we create structures for more access. I'm not going to say complete access because I don't think it is, but we create structures for more access, but we don't pair them with supports for success. And that occurs, I think, at every level, right? PK-12 teachers in rural areas who have differential resources than, you know, teachers who are at private high schools in major cities or anywhere, really. Or folks who are saying, well, we go and recruit, like colleges, we go and recruit in rural areas, but then we have no supports on campus for folks to meet other people who are from rural areas. We did some research recently, and we're in the process of writing this up for publication, but Ty McNamee, who's at Teachers College Columbia, sort of led that project, and some of the students that we interviewed, rural students, said, you know, one student particularly was talking about, you know, I identify as a Black woman from a rural area. I'm 0.01% of the population on my campus. And so how is that student meeting other people who share some of their experiences and identity and perspective? Because another student, for example, gave a quote around, I met other folks in rural areas and I finally felt like a sense of like connection and ability to see myself in this space. And I thought about that for myself as a student. Some of the people I've had the best relationships with in college that I met were from other rural small towns in Louisiana who are from working class families. And that happened across race. And so because we connected over, we could have the conversations about race. And I'm thinking particularly about my friend, her name is Lakia Jones. And we would often have these intense conversations about race and then connect over how our rural working class backgrounds are led us to very similar sort of perspectives or outcomes or those sorts of things. So having those structures in place to support students, or you may say, well, you know, we're closing the residence halls for break or whatever. Well, that's a social class issue, but it's also like a geographic issue, because what if you live further and you don't have the ability, especially if you're from a rural area and you're a working class student, how are you getting home? Like, what does that mean and look like for you? And some institutions are starting to think about those things and starting to put new policies and practices in place, and some just aren't, right? They're worried about getting people in the door to say they have them, but they're not necessarily worried about the type of experience they're having while they're there. Some it's just, again, differently than others. Community colleges have been doing this for a really long time, and so what can we learn from community colleges? Mm-hmm. I think sometimes our four-year institutions get into their egos about we don't have anything to learn from two-year institutions, and sometimes two-year institutions have been doing it longer and are maybe have scalable practices that we can utilize at four-year institutions. And I think the same is true for organizations and corporations, right? So maybe you're going to recruit folks from different geographic areas, but you don't want them to work remotely. And so what if they want to live in that rural area and your company is in San Francisco or Atlanta or wherever? And so do you have policies in place that would allow you to include more people from sort of different geographic areas or different social identity backgrounds and benefit your institution or your organization while still living maybe where they want to live in a rural community? And so I think there are lots of policy and practice things as we think about sort of shifting dynamics in the workforce both at higher ed institutions and at other corporations and organizations. If we want to recruit and retain people, how are we creating policies and practices that invite them to be who they are and where they want to be, and still contribute to the purpose, mission, responsibilities of the organization?
Well, you know, and I think even like needing to deal with our internalized like stereotypes of like rural and poor and working class, and what does that mean? Because there's all kinds of like stuff connected with you know, the way that people may have implicit bias and not even recognize it, whether it be around, oh, this is where you're from, or this is how you found it, or this is how you got your degree, and or where you got your degree, and how do we like really talk about that in like authentic ways without it being shameful or embarrassing, and be like, yep, I'm holding this bias, and that's something that I've got to work on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I think of a specific example. A couple weeks ago, I was back up in Boston, and we were checking at the hotel, and I was talking to the desk attendant at the hotel, and he asked me where we were coming from, and I said, oh, we're coming from North Carolina, and he was like, I knew it was somewhere in the South. And it was such a moment for me because I lived in Boston. I got that a lot when I lived in Boston, like, oh, you're from somewhere in the South. And for me, I'm like, Southern accents are distinct. Like, I can tell you somebody's from South Georgia compared to Louisiana compared to East Texas, but that's because I've lived in that region, right? Versus, as he was speaking, my first thought was, oh, my gosh, you must originally be from Boston, based on his accent, right? And so it was this interesting moment of, what assumptions are you making about people based on their accent, their dialect, their word choice, like all of those sorts of things? Because I did, when I moved to Boston, have some anxiousness around, I'm going to talk and people are going to automatically know where I'm from and they're going to make assumptions about that. And I don't think as I walk around in my day, right, in the world, that people assume I come from a working class family. Like, I don't think they assume that. And then I will say certain things and they're like, oh, wait, right? Like, you can see there's dissonance in what they're assuming about me, either based on what I'm wearing or how I'm talking, or where they met me or how they know me, right? So do they know me at the local bar over a beer, or do they know me in the classroom as their professor? And so that is really interesting, too, in terms of contextualization and the assumptions we make.
Hmm. So much to come back from break and continue digging into. Would you mind letting people know how to find you in case they would love further conversation, invite you to come speak at their organization, help them dismantle classism directly?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks can find me via email. So it is my name, Sonja Ardoin, S-O-N-J-A-A-R-D-O-I-N @gmail.com. I also have a website that is www.sonjaardoin.com, and on Twitter @SonjaArdoin is my handle.
Can't wait till we come back to more Transformation Change Radio. We'll see you all on the other side of the break.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Are you ready to experience full body system wellness? Tune in to the Empower Me Show with Pam Bright, a spiritual toolbox for your life. Embrace the fullness of who you are as a spiritual being, having a human experience. Pam Bright is a multidimensional healer, light language channel, energy intuitive, and spiritual transformation coach. Join her for a rich conversation about how to unlock all your spiritual gifts on Transformation Talk Radio.
Are you having difficulty feeling at home in your own home? Join Annette Rigolo and Dr. Pat in Enlightened Environments, Optimizing from the Outside In, as they present a deep dive into the various vibrations of the Earth, along with man-made energies that impact our lives. Using the Diamond Dowsing Method, we will utilize specific vibrations to elevate our own homes to support us and expand us with their energy. Join us every third Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time to make your home, home.
It is time to get inspired to take action in your life. Tune in to Emotional Elevation with me, Susan Denae. We are identifying, understanding, and treating our crazy one episode at a time. We all have crazy in our lives. The thing that sets us apart is how we deal with it. and I've got you covered. Enjoy your journey. You are worth it. Visit SusanDenae.com. That's D-E-N-E-E.com.
Illuminate your inner framework now with Shelley Hofberg and Stephanie Salt on the show Intuitive Diagnostics on Psychic Horizons. For you to find the keys to your highest path, it is vital that you see what is happening within your inner metric of you and those around you. They'll help you utilize soul architecture so that you can unravel the highest plan of life actualization for you. Manifest your unique life mission now. Every Thursday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Are you ready to get big and live your life out loud? Tune in to Get Big Out Loud Radio, exploring life through the lens of curiosity and compassion. With me, Sherry Knudsen, joining Dr. Pat live every second Monday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. I will offer ideas to transform what you are thinking into conscious action. If you want to get big and live your life out loud, visit me at KnudsenSpeaks.com.
Are you wondering who you are meant to be in this ever-changing world right now? Kelly Kay is a certified new paradigm multidimensional transformation energy healer ready to assist you in this transformative process of expanding your consciousness. She helps you transmute your wounds and traumas into healing, growth, and wisdom, resulting in self-empowerment and freedom from fear. Visit enlightenedmedicine.com to learn more.
Wonderful. Welcome back. We had a great break conversation, and we're going to continue to engage with Sandra, especially as we think about, we had ended with rurality and geography and, accents and dialect, and, what are some of those implicit biases that folks may hold or do hold as we think about what we just talked about?
Yeah, I think that, I mentioned sort of the get-out mentality, right? So folks assume that you were, like, the chosen one, right? Like, oh, you were able to get out, or oh, you left, or, all of those sorts of things, which I think are really complex for the people who are being deemed that, because they may not, want to get out, or they may not feel like they're exceptional or special or, those sorts of things. And I think it also creates some dynamics around creating what the literature calls dual alienation, right? So you don't feel like you completely fit in your hometown anymore. And I've been told, why you don't talk about that no more? Why you always so dressed up? All of those sorts of things. So you're sort of ostracized in a bit from your home community, but then your sort of new space, whatever that is, right? Your business, your organization, your higher ed institution also doesn't fully sort of understand or get your perspective or where you're coming from. And so you're sort of still an outsider there too. And so it leaves you sort of in this limbo, liminal space that is really interesting to navigate. I think that folks also assume that, like, maybe you have not had any experiences. And so, you don't know anything about sort of music or the arts or like all, and there's amazing sort of artistry and, in rural communities. There's a book called Appalachian Reckoning that I read a couple years ago, and it was all about diverse people in rural areas and how they are poets and artists and musicians and all kinds of artistic-based things. But folks, I think, look at rurality and assume farming. They assume mining or other kinds of extraction, and they assume sort of like desolate, right? And rural areas can be beautiful and engaging and, organized around collectivism and activist communities and, all of those sorts of things too. So I think there is an assumption about lack, a lack of opportunity, a lack of interest, that's just a lack, when often I think of my rural community as vibrant in all kinds of ways. And no, maybe there wasn't, a movie theater within an hour, or there wasn't a mall within an hour, or there wasn't, all of those sorts of things, but in other ways, mom and pop shops and restaurants, and folks know your name, and there's a vibrancy to that as well. I think there's also perceptions, like I said, that most people in rural communities are poor or working class, and there's a town not far from the town I live right now where, I get like emails from Zillow or whatever from when I was house searching, and all of the houses in that area are over $1 million. And so it is a sort of a rural community that has been created almost as an enclave for affluent folks. And so, like, what does that mean? And so I think there's these interesting sort of assumptions, both around sort of a deficit or lack, and this conflation of different identities that rural means white or rural means poor or rural means this, and that may or may not be true. And it may be different for different people who live in that same rural community as well. And so thinking about what that means and looks like. And some rural areas are vacation destinations, right? So there are places in Western North Carolina where I live now that you couldn't buy, like, it's, nobody can buy a house. There's no inventory. But then also, like, it is really expensive because people are using it as like, a second home or, you know, all of those sorts of pieces as well. So I think those are interesting. I think there's also an assumption that there is no opportunity. And so thinking about what does that mean to look like in terms of education or jobs or all of those pieces. And so, you know, I am a rural first-gen working-class student, but there are also folks where I grew up who are definitely not first-generation college students. Their parents were the doctor in town, or they were the lawyer in town. And so understanding, again, that you can't make these assumptions that this equals that, because while that is my story and that is true for me, that is not true for everybody that I went to high school with or college with. And then I even think about my partner. His cousin is a first-generation college student, but his uncle owns his own roofing business. And that's a good business in sort of the Northern Virginia area. And so she, while she's a first-generation college student, she is not really from, she didn't identify as coming from a working-class background because finances weren't an issue. Her parents were part of sort of these community organizations where social capital wasn't an issue. And so there are some interesting distinctions there as well. So I think, in short, I guess what I'm saying is people should get to know people and sort of hear their stories and learn who they are and not make assumptions about, you know, if you're rural and you're also working class or then you're also a first-gen student or, you know, that's true for some people and for other people that's absolutely not their story.
And if you talk about deficit and lack of resources and access, I think folks like me who grew up more middle class, if not upper middle class, also did at the individual level. You're rural, you are then deficit, you are not as smart, you're not as developed, you're not as capable. And so being a laborer and serving us in our Asheville upper middle class community is what your role in life is, and get back in your place. My fear is, as you were talking, I was like, I wonder what the percentage, you may know, of folks who are faculty and staff in higher ed that come from more of a middle, upper middle class background who might also have biases, who then see their job as, let me help these rural students, assuming they're all poor, that whole pull yourself by your bootstraps, but that deficit mentality that whites do with all folk of color, indigenous folk. My fear is around all folk that are rural, cross race, cross class background, still is that deficit, we're here to help you, that patronizing savior mentality. So what do you find in your experience, research, and more? How do you help folks like me so at universities so that we're useful and not replicating classism?
Yeah, and I think to your point, Kathy, I think that happens around social class. I also think it happens around morality, and neither of them, I would argue, we have good data on at an institutional level. And so the challenge being that our social class marker in higher ed is Pell eligibility, and that only applies to undergraduate students, number one. You can't get Pell if you're not an undergraduate student. Number two, it is a limiting marker because not everybody can complete a FAFSA, or FAFSA, however you say the acronym. Not everybody can complete one because they may not have the information from their families. They don't want to give it to them. They might be somebody who is undocumented or a DACA student. They might be an international student. And so none of those folks would qualify for Pell because they wouldn't have completed the FAFSA, or they're not eligible to complete the FAFSA, or those sorts of things. So I would say that when we look at Pell eligibility, it's about 33% across the country, and I would argue that's a bottom baseline, right? Like that is the lowest amount. So we likely have more than that third who at least undergraduate students who identify as coming from poor and working class backgrounds. And so, and that's just the financial piece. That's not looking at all the other pieces of social class. So it's also a very narrow view to just finances and not sort of the broader holistic nature of social class either. And then when it comes to rurality, we really don't have data. I mean, we can look at like county level data or zip code data, but there's limitations to some of that as well. And that is not as sort of publicized by institutions, right? They're not, they may say we have students from X counties in our state or X states or X countries or like those sorts of things, but they don't necessarily disaggregate the data in ways that truly show if they're recruiting rural students. Now, there might be more of that as they're creating positions to sort of track that, but we don't really have great data there either. So I don't know that people always know. Even first gen, we're using different definitions, right? So the Center for First Gen Student Success put out some research around there saying, you know, here are some of the common definitions. There were about 7 or 8 that different institutions are using. But then if you're comparing, right, you're not comparing the same things because people are using different definitions. And there was a study that Rob Tekushin and some other folks at UGA did that they took the same sample of students and applied different definitions of first gen. And the range of students who were identified as first gen went from 22% to 22% to 77%. That's a 55% error. And so all that to say, we don't have good data. And I think people still make assumptions, right? So if a student's writing a paper and they mention their home community or they raise their hand in class and share an example about, you know, in an engineering class about fixing a motor on a tractor, that's going to land less well than a student who talks about fixing a motor on their parent's sports car or their sports car or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so we have heard from some students in our research about how I don't engage as much in the classroom or maybe don't join things or, you know, I'm having challenges in terms of social connection and engagement because people don't get me, right? I try to share and I try to engage and it either doesn't land well or people don't have any idea what I'm talking about or they don't value sort of the skills and perspectives I bring. They sort of treat them as less than. And so I think it's a matter of for employees at Institute thinking about how do we rearrange our understanding of what is valuable and how, and that is structural, right? So thinking about do we make comments on students' papers or assignments or those sorts of things, but it's also how do we code things with award criteria or scholarship criteria or all of those sorts of things as well to say, oh, well, that's not as valuable, right? Like you worked on your parents' farm or in your parents' business or whatever, and that's not as valuable as if you were on the debate team or that you know, did whatever. And so how are we looking at it from a skills-based perspective versus just a title or like something we are more familiar with perspective?
Oh, my goodness. That is a system right there as I think about that. And even, you know, even around language, one of the things that I have appreciated, Sandra will share stories with me as an academic, and the resistance to even using the language for.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You know, she has been told, like, you can't use this word.
How come and what?
Yeah, so it's been fascinating. So earlier in my writing, as I was writing about this, folks were like, you know, it's just crass. Like, it's like not language. You should, like, the word school is sort of like crass, and you shouldn't use that. And I pushed back on that and was like, no, like, here are all the reasons. And even after we sort of established that language, right, like, Becky and I wrote a book. Like, we wrote another book. I wrote some other stuff. And we wrote some chapters together. But the reviewers, whether it's reviewers for conference proposals, reviewers for journal articles, reviewers for book chapters, et cetera, will come back and basically say, like, literally, they will say, like, you, the person who's proposing this must not know anything about social class if they're going to use the word poor. And so sometimes, like, there's nothing you can do about it. Like, the proposal is just rejected because the reviewers have that perspective. And then other times we sort of push back and said, hey, like, here's why we're using the language. Here's why it's appropriate. Like, nobody who grew up poor doesn't know that they grew up poor. But, you know, people know. It's not, you know, I sort of liken it to, and it's not the same, but, like, if we can't say the word black, we can't talk about race. If we can't say the word queer, we can't talk about sexuality, right? And if we can't say the word poor, we really can't talk about social class. And some of the feedback has been, well, it makes people uncomfortable. And my question always is, which people? So I think, you know, it's similar to some of these bills in the legislature right now that are talking about divisive concepts, like divisive for who? And so I think that that's interesting to sort of think about. And even to the point where I had a chapter that I wrote that they changed the language in the editing process. I changed it back to say, hey, no, like this is the language I want to use and here's why. And when I got the printed copy, the printed book, the chapter was wrong. They changed my language, which is problematic for a number of reasons. One, because now if people cite it, they're going to cite it incorrectly. That's not what I actually mean. But two, it feeds into the narrative that it's not okay to use. And they're okay with the term working class. It's the term poor. They want to change to low income. And I think those mean different things, right? You can be low income and be poor. You can be poor perhaps sometimes and not be necessarily low income, maybe. But, like, so they're not, you know, it's not a synonym. And so they mean different things in terms of narrowness or more broad.
The arrogant sense of entitlement and power that is in hierarchical editors who can select conferences. And so,
Yeah, so I would say we need some training if people can't even say the word poor.
Right. So that's what I'm wondering, Becky. We just have a little bit left. I'm wondering about what is possible. What have you seen happen? And I know, Becky, you're doing a lot more work on dismantling classism as well than anybody else I know as a consultant and trainer. And so what can we do in organizations to look at individual bias, behaviors, as well as systemic practices, culture? Just what is needed?
Yeah, and I want to hear Becky's perspective on this as well. I think one is having people literally talk about it. Like talk about, say the word poor. Say what you associate with the word poor. Like literally just put it out there in the world, like naming all of those things. Like why are you afraid? Like why are you afraid to say this word? Why might we be afraid to see or approach or talk to folks who are housing insecure, right, or identified homeless? What does that mean? You know, why are we afraid to talk to a student about the fact that when they say to us, hey, I can't afford this textbook for class, do we just say, oh, I'm sorry, like, you know, figure it out? Do we assist them with that? There's been an issue that I've been managing or trying to help with on my campus that there was a student who uses EBT, so like government assistance with food, and they tried to use their EBT card on campus and couldn't. And we asked some questions about why, and it's because the university had never asked for the number you need to be able to use it on campus, which is seemingly simple, but then they're like, oh, we need a separate swipe. You can't swipe with a regular credit card swipe for EBT card. You have to have a special swipe. And so it seems that the university will be able to do that, but what does that mean for the student who goes to swipe and somebody notices, oh, it swipes in a different card? And maybe they don't say anything or maybe that doesn't happen, but there's always these distinctions. And so thinking about how are we pushing for some of these things, because sometimes people don't even realize it. I don't know if it was an assumption that nobody on our campus needs it. I don't know if it's that nobody has shared their story before and trying to use it and not being able to. But how are we talking about it more? Because then we can see where the gaps are and we can see where the classism has showed up or just ignorance has showed up. Or lack of knowing, and we can address some of those things. I think some campuses want to do it, and organizations want to do it. They have a desire, or at least they're beginning to. But I think we have to start by talking about it, because if we don't talk about it and have no awareness, we can't ever get to the structural pieces.
Yeah. And I think that that's what I've been, Kathy and I have talked about in some shows, right? It's like, we want to be able to name it. Like, if we can't name it, then we can't engage it at any level. And there's so much like discomfort and shame and embarrassment or lack of language or lack of knowing. And so, you know, institutions are, they'll have full tuition for 4 years if students need a particular, or students, like their family's income is, you know, at a particular level. And so we're bringing all of these students in, but we're not talking about it. And so they feel left out, not connected. Or we're bringing even faculty and staff and administrators in, assuming that they come from middle-class backgrounds because we don't talk about that. And if we, you know, once we can talk about it, then we can be clear, but then we can see where the gaps are. Right, better understand where the gaps are. So then we can say, oh, EBT card, we hadn't even thought about that. And we can say, we messed it up.
Yeah.
But, you know, organizationally, that's really difficult because then it's like, connected to, you know, white supremacy and perfection and needing to have all of the answers. And so then it gets messy. So then you won't talk about it. But, like, just say, you know what, we didn't know. And how, like, and that's deep work, I think, for individuals that are, in, like, for a VP to, right? So, like, how are we coaching even faculty and staff when a student brings something to them to say, okay, let's sit down and talk about this, but I don't have any information or skills or knowing that I'm going to do exactly what Sean just said, is say, sorry. And leave it at that and not do anything with the forward movement.
Yeah, and I think as you were talking, Mickey, the other thing that came up for me was I think about a specific instance when I worked at Boston University. We assume certain employees on campuses come from certain social class backgrounds, right? And so people might assume, right, that folks who are on grounds crew or custodial staff or those sorts of things are coming from foreign working class backgrounds. And we might assume that upper-level administrators, faculty are coming from middle to upper-class backgrounds. And I remember instance when I was at BU that that distinction was flipped because one of our custodial staff members in our building actually had her PhD, but it was from another country. And so the United States was not recognizing her PhD, but in terms of other forms of capital now, it shifted based on what country she was in. But I don't know that she would have defined herself necessarily as coming from a working class background because in her country that she came from, it was not, right? Like, she had a PhD, she had this job, she came from sort of a more affluent family versus I had come from this working class family in rural area and I was the faculty member. And so the institution wasn't set up to support either of us in sort of how we were experiencing the environment and the culture and those sorts of things. And so, again, the assumptions we make about who's coming from where and what identities they hold, I think can be really interesting and incorrect.
And as soon as somebody realized she has a PhD, all of a sudden she got treated better probably from some of the other. I wonder if we can be looking at some of the structural shifts around dismantling racism to see if there's any employee resource group or affinity groups. Work with folks who grew up and or currently have class privilege to work our privilege in accountability groups. The same kind of questions we ask when we're using a race lens. How is this impacting across racialized identity? Who's getting underprivileged? I wonder if there's similar questions. And so listeners may be going, I don't know anything about, but I think we know a lot about beginning to question and dismantle undeserved discrimination, bias, and policies and practices that only serve people in privileged groups. So listeners, just breathe. I don't think it's as hard as some of us might be making it up. We know a lot. And whiteness and class privilege are so, I'll bet, ingrained as well that that might be another conversation. We just have a couple minutes left. Sandra, is there anything else you would like to just leave as parting thoughts? And then also, how can people find you? Because I think both of y'all are going to get calls about come help us understand class, talk about it, and then do systemic change. So,
yeah, the last sort of piece I want to mention is if you are job searching, if you are hiring people in a search process, be transparent about some of those components that show up in job searches, whether that is if you expect people to wear a specific thing, tell them that you expect them to wear a specific thing, and then think about what that means, that you're telling them that they should be wearing a specific thing. But then also think about how are we transparent about what salaries are? How are we transparent about what cost of living is in the area? And then how are we transparent in the negotiation process? I didn't negotiate my probably first 3 or 4 job searches, and that has cumulative impact. I didn't know I could negotiate. I was uncomfortable negotiating. I didn't see a need to negotiate because I was making more money than my parents had ever made combined, and I didn't know that you could make more money than that. I mean, I guess I knew, but it never seemed realistic for me. And so how can we say to people, here is actually what the top of the salary range is, and we're just going to give it to you. We're not going to make you sort of grovel and beg to get there, or that person B gets it because they knew to ask and person A doesn't get it because they didn't know or didn't feel comfortable asking based on the identities that they hold. And so I would just encourage folks, if you are a job searcher or seeker, to ask those questions, to negotiate for yourself, to talk to people, to coach yourself up and feel confident doing that. And if you're a job hirer, how do you make that process transparent and not complicated for folks or not privileged folks who come from certain identities and not other identities in that process? And post your salaries. Like, that'd be really helpful for people. And if you could just do that.
Be upfront about it.
Yes.
Right? And so even as I hear that, Sandra, how do you be upfront about it so that even the seeker doesn't have to go through all of that?
Yes.
Like that, to me, Kathy, is a systems change.
Can you imagine if in the mission and vision they say we're wanting to create an inclusive to dismantle racism, classism, other forms of oppression, and we're not there yet. We want to recruit folks who can help us.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? You start asking for what the skills and competencies are. Just a moment left. Sandra, how can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So folks can find me via my email, which is my name, sanjaardoin at gmail.com. So S-O-N-J-A-A-R-D-O-I-N at gmail.com. My website, which is www.sanjaardoin.com. Or on Twitter, I'm at sanjaardoin as my handle.
Final thoughts, Dr. Becky Martinez?
Thank you. Like, thank you so much for being you in this space and talking about it from the individual to the systems level. And my hope is that people can reflect and think about, how does it show up in how I supervise or how I lead or how I create a policy or a practice or how I talk about it with my family? All of those different components are part of shifting this class dynamic. So thank you for you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I join in the thank you. I am challenged, given my class privilege, to be thinking as well in my own practice, but as well as how can I challenge folks to dismantle classism. So everybody just keep breathing. Step by step, we will do this. Transformation Change Radio with Dr. Becky Martinez, Dr. Kathy O'Bear, Dr. Sandra, thank you so much. Next time, we'll be with Dr. Tanya Williams, talking about maybe with a bit more of a nonprofit feel as well. Can't wait. And Tanya has worked with Class Action. I know Becky has been on the board. So we're just going to keep building our capacity and competency. Till next time, go well and dismantle classism.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy O'Bear on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change, motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyobear.com. That's drkathyobear.com.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program, and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good sunny Wednesday to you. Benny Mathers here for a look at your Alternative Talk AM 1150 traffic update for around the town. We'll start things off over on I-90 westbound, just west of Westlake Sammamish Parkway around mile post 14. A recent collision partially blocking the two right lanes. Also 405 southbound, still just south of the 527. The collision partially blocking most of the lanes. The current backup was early around 2 miles. Now it's about 5 miles, so bring your patients along with you there. That's 405 southbound, just south of the 527. And also I-5 southbound, just south of 236th Street, northeast, around milepost 210. A recent collision still partially blocking most of the lanes in that area. Stay tuned. Coming up next, after the news and weather, it's another hour of the Transformation Talk Radio Network.
NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. Despite falling gas prices, the national average remains well over $4. AAA reports the national average price for regular is down 1 cent to $4.16 a gallon today. That's 7 cents a gallon lower than a week ago and 17 cents below the peak of $4.33 a gallon last month. President Biden is unveiling new global sanctions against Russia. Speaking to a building trade union conference in Washington, D.C., Biden said the U.S. will impose full blocking sanctions on Sberbank and Alpha Bank, Russia's largest private bank.
Second, I'm going to sign an executive order that's going to ban any new U.S. investment in Russia. More than 600 private sector companies.
Biden insisted the ongoing sanctions are wiping out the past 15 years of economic gains in Russia. He condemned the Russian invasion of Ukraine, calling it brutal. He also praised the bravery and resilience of Ukrainians. Biden warned that the war could last a long time and insisted that the U.S. and allies will continue to stand with Ukraine. At least two people are dead after storms wreaked havoc from Texas to South Carolina Tuesday. The deaths were reported in East Texas and eastern Georgia. Another storm system will threaten parts of the South again today, including Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, and Florida. Chris Rock is making a surprise appearance at a New York City comedy club. Lisa G reports.
The Brooklyn native took the stage at Comedy Cellar Tuesday night, and according to Page Six, he told the audience he wouldn't be talking about the Will Smith slap. After the crowd went wild with applause, Rock told them to lower their expectations because he wasn't going to be addressing the Oscars incident. Rock launched his comedy tour last week in Boston and has been workshopping material. Lisa G., New York.
The U.S. Coast Guard Vice Commandant Linda Fagan is making history as the first woman to be nominated to lead the military branch. President Biden nominated Admiral Fagan for the position of Coast Guard Commandant yesterday. If confirmed by the Senate, Fagan will become the first woman to lead any branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
AJNW can help you build a rewarding show and podcast. Here's just one of our happy hosts.
Hi, this is Dr. Kay, host of Dr. Kay's Attuning to Your Abundance. I emphatically recommend you to the team at KKNW. The station is a great place for lots of messages, especially poets, writers, storytellers, singers, and musicians.
Learn more about hosting your own show and podcast. Call 425-653-1150.
And let's go ahead and take a look now to our alternative talk weather outlook for Wednesday. Well, after that patchy fog burns off and we climb out of those crisp morning temperatures, we'll see 58, 59 degrees today and mostly cloudy skies. A few sun breaks here and there. Tonight, though, more clouds rolling back in. Low temperatures back down to about 44. For Thursday, partly sunny skies, highs of around 68, 69. Yeah, going to be a warm one. But that will step away. The mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain moving in for Thursday night. Lows back down to about 48. For Friday and running up into the weekend, more clouds and rain expected. High temperatures in the mid-50s. With, yeah, it looks like on Sunday, temperatures dropping. That might mean mixed rain and snow showers in selected areas. Welcome to spring.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Basile and Transformation Talk Radio.
Transmutation time, energetic alchemy for an amazing life. Your past can stick with you, and most of the time it's subconscious. You don't even know that it's happening. Let Kelly Kay and Dr. Pat help bring your shadow into the light so you can begin to truly heal and grow. You have the power to shift your energetic ties to the past and thereby shift your life. Stop being stuck in your karmic patterns and transmute your pain or unhealthy ways of being into wisdom and joy. Are you ready to live a more conscious life, to act instead of react, to be present and balanced even in the face of challenges? It's time to turn trauma into transcendence. Transmutation time, energetic alchemy for an amazing life, with Kelly Kay starts now.
Hi, everybody. I'm so excited to talk today about transmutation and ascension and how it all connects in. So it's a big topic. We'll, you know, do the best we can to at least give an overview of it. But, yeah, ascension to me, it's the pinnacle of what we are all trying to do as souls on this planet right now. We are trying to get closer to source, get closer to our higher self. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about what all that means and how transmutation is a big part of it. But anyone, like I know you, Dr. Pat,
yeah,
has been on this journey for a long time. We know that it's an ongoing journey. It's not just like, oh, okay, we work on ascension for a year and then it's done. It's really a lifelong process, isn't it?
And I love the way you talk about it, because very few people, if any that I know of, really embrace transmutation the way you do, Kelly Kay. And the reason that this is so important, and I was joking before the show about what we're going to talk about today, but I'm realizing that we are here in the world with real practical experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, there's such a practical way to really look at the energies of this, and yet it's very hard to find someone like you that has the great weaving of all the spiritual elements, all of the practical elements, all of the elements of this world, all of the elements of the other world. And you know what I love? You know, I think you're doing a workshop. I don't know if you have any more slots left.
But I think you're doing a workshop on a new paradigm and this multidimensional transformation, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm so excited. Gosh. I know. So,
do you have any slots left, or did I make that up?
I do
up?
In May.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I'm teaching one in April. I'm actually teaching one in like 2 weeks. That one is full, but I'm teaching one in May that still has a couple slots left, and I'm in Chicago area, so really easy to fly into. And if you feel drawn to do this kind of transmutation ascension work, the live workshops are so powerful. There's something about sitting in a group of like-minded people. Everyone is focusing on what can they let go of, what doesn't serve them anymore, right? What does it mean to them to be connected to their higher self and to source? And we, you know, it's an intense 2 days. We do a lot of clearing work, a lot of activation work, and it's beautiful. And I've been teaching it for, 6 years now, and just seeing how it transforms people's lives when they put this as a priority and understanding that, like you said, I believe it's what we're all doing. It's why we're here having these earthly experiences, is to learn and to grow. And, you know, my personal belief about, like, you know, that there's reincarnation and that we come back again and again and we learn these lessons, or we don't learn them. And if we don't learn them, then we come back again, you know, to try to relearn as best we can. And ascension is basically saying, you know, maybe I don't want to have to come back and keep learning the same lesson over and over. And even if you don't believe in reincarnation, a lot of people can see it even in this life, right? Of like, man, I've had the same lesson over and over in this life. Why does it keep hitting me? So ascension is about, okay, let's look at that. Let's transmute the energy around that so that you don't have to feel like you're just living in a loop. And so, yeah, the workshop that I'm teaching is really powerful for that. Or I can do the work remotely if you're not in the Chicago area or it's not easy for you to travel. I do individual sessions where we focus on this too, because it is individual. We all have different lessons, and sometimes it's hard to see it ourselves, because to us it's normal. To us it's like, well, this is, yeah, just how life is and how things have been. But when someone can give you that outside perspective of like, you know what, based on what you told me, I'm seeing a pattern here. Are you ready to shift that pattern? And it's not always easy, but that's where, you know, the work comes in, and that's what I do.
You know, let's just get into that, because this is about spiritual ascension and this show today. And the fact that you're offering these things, I think there are some people maybe that can get from where they are to where they want to go with their own level of self-awareness. I have not been one of them. You know, I have worked and have had angels and mentors all my life, from a very, very young age, actually. I didn't know they were that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know my favorite uncle, who used to go out of his way, and he knew I walked home from school by myself, and he drove, like, I think, what is it, a UPS truck, and he would come by. He would go from, like, North Jersey to Plainfield just to see me walking. I mean, angels like that. But there's an energy that gets transferred. And I would love for you to talk about this transfer of energy that people are feeling and focusing on in the time we're living in now. What clicked for us to really bump this up to a priority?
Yeah, it is really interesting times that we're in. I personally believe we're in actually like an ascension window, meaning that there is an opportunity for many souls right now to clear a lot of karma and to actually get out of that wheel of reincarnation if they choose to. And that's not always like that on this planet. There's definitely, you know, if you look back in history, there's hundreds of years, thousands of years where, you know, life is pretty much just about survival, and that everyone's energy was just going towards that. There wasn't necessarily a lot of extra time or teachings around, let's, you know, try to reach enlightenment or let's try to ascend. It just wasn't even part of people's. It was just, can I feed my children or can I, you know, survive this winter? So we've reached a point where there is enough, I believe, being able to move past just the bare bones of survival, and that's what gives the opportunity with our modern civilization to say, okay, how do we spend our free time and, you know, some extra money that we might have or some extra ability to study? The amount of knowledge that's out there right now is incredible. I mean, the amount of books and the amount of stuff on the internet, but that's where, to me, it's helpful to have a guide, because it's almost too much sometimes, and you look over all of it and it's like, gosh, where do I even begin? And that is an opportunity, though, to have access to so much knowledge to be able to start to study and really focus on, okay, how do I grow spiritually? This, you know, can be a priority for a lot of people at this time. And also, I believe the energies of the earth and human consciousness are continuing to ascend. So it's not just a personal thing. It's collective consciousness of humanity. It's the planetary energies keep getting higher, which pushes us to grow along with it. And so, you know, same with even analyzing, you know, our traumas and how they might be affecting us. You know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that wasn't really, you know, only the top richest people maybe had time to consider seeing, you know, someone to analyze their what they've been through in life. But it wasn't really, you just, you know, kind of sucked it up, right, and moved on to the next thing. And so that gathers over time. And again, you know, with like the reincarnation pattern, many people had many lifetimes where they just, you know, it was about survival, a lot of rough things happened, they died. That's it. No time to process that energy. So now there's a window where we can process not only what's in this life, if we choose to, but start to clear and transmute many, many lifetimes. We didn't have a chance to do that. We didn't have a teacher or a guide. Yeah. And so what a blessing, I think.
I think it's a blessing, too. And I want to talk to you about this because I haven't always thought it's a blessing. But I can feel it in what we're doing as a network, and I can feel it in my personal life. And, you know, this idea that you're talking about, this transmutation energy to ascension is, I mean, somebody asked me if I knew another word for it. And the only thing I could say to them is the word speaks for itself, and yet you can define what it means for you. Mm-hmm. And I said, think about how many times the word ascension has been used. Think about yourself. Think about the beautiful image. It doesn't matter what your spiritual practice is, whether you practice Buddhism or Christianity, mm-hmm. or you have a Muslim belief, but none of that matters. There's an energy that shows through when you can visualize ascension. There's a lightness to it, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
Right? It's like you've left all of the baggage on Benny's doorstep.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's a good clarification, right? It's not a religious practice in and of itself, right? It can be, part of any religious practice. And that, to me, it is actually kind of a physics of energy, and it's a lightening of energy, because when we have stuff in our past that we haven't processed, meaning something difficult has happened to us, but we haven't had time to sit with it, to clear it, to acknowledge the emotions behind it, it just sits there. You know, like we've talked about in previous episodes, unless we do the work to try to transmute it. And so as we transmute it, yes, people start feeling lighter, they start feeling freer, and they start becoming more of their higher self. And again, that's, you know, that can be part of any religious belief. There's different words for it, but the idea, you know, you could say you're closer to your true soul essence. You're closer to God. You're closer to the Great Spirit. Whatever word you want to use, all the different religious teachings actually have a concept of this, right? Of returning to that state where a lot of our baggage has been left behind and feel bright again.
I want to talk with you about one thing in particular, because it's something that you talk about, and I know you teach this. It is not that we have to become perfect in. So we have this language in this human skin that I don't think exists in any spiritual realm. For example, we use time. I do not think time exists in a spiritual realm. And, of course, if you want to go watch Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, you will certainly see that what I'm saying is true. That's like a movie, so it's not even real. But what I'm trying to say is, people that engage in lack of anything, you know what I'm saying? Like the lack energy.
Mm-hmm.
And lack can be transmuted, right?
Absolutely.
So here's where I'm going. When we let go of what we believe is perfection and allow for that, a level of peace transmutes into our energy. And I would like you to talk to that. Let me give it to people in practical terms, and then you take it away. I had a mentor that said to me, focus, focus, Pat. If you're going to focus on that, watch out. You're going to get so much of it, you're not even going to believe or understand that you're getting it. And he would say that for both positive or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found myself waking up, and I'm supposed to be monitoring a wire transfer. And I woke up today, not in surrender, not in letting go. There's absolutely no reason about how we handle finances with our bank that anything would go wrong. But why would that come into my thoughts? And then what happens when we descend? Right? Hello, right?
Right.
So can you talk about this window that will allow us to shake off those things that probably have been grabbing onto us like a giant crab and holding on to us in the moment, in the year, in the day, and preventing us from rising up?
Yes, I'm really glad you brought up that concept of perfection, and because I do see it a lot when we start talking about ascension, sometimes there's a misunderstanding of, oh, well, that's a place that once I am ascended or enlightened or whatever word you want to use, you know, self-realized, everything will be perfect. My life will be perfect. I will have no problems. You know, I will. Yeah. It's only, but our world isn't, it's a world of duality. It's here to test us and challenge us. I believe that's how we grow. We don't grow from, you know, just everything being the same in our entire life. It might be peaceful, but that's, soul growth happens when, you know, we're challenged or something new comes our way that we don't expect. And so this idea of perfection, you know, I really want people to let go of this, like, oh, I'll be happy when, because that's what starts to happen. Oh, I'll be happy when I'm ascended. I'll be happy when all of this, and it can happen now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has to happen in the now, because like what you were saying about time, it is kind of an illusion. So if we're always waiting, that brings in the energy of, I'm waiting for my life to be good. I'm waiting for these wonderful things to happen. And instead, when we say, mm-hmm. I am getting lighter now, I'm ascending now, I'm owning my higher self now, and we put it in those terms,
mm-hmm.
we can start to see that it is unfolding now around us, and we stop needing it to look perfect. And, you know, you see that a lot with, like, New Age teachings that talk about, oh, we're moving into the fifth dimension, and then everything is going to be a golden age, and it's going to be all, and I'm like, well, you know, it might start getting into that golden age at some point, but that doesn't necessarily mean, again, that there's going to never be a challenge or never be disagreements between people. There's always going to be different viewpoints and different things that happen that are challenging and unexpected. And in my opinion, ascension teaches us to handle all of it with grace and to stay in our center no matter what happens to us. And so that's the gift and that's the key.
Yeah, I love, can I jump in for a minute? And I want you to talk about this as well. I've had a lot of great mentors. My mom, you know, I refer to her as Doris, Mama Doris. My stepmom jumped in after my mom passed away. She was so full of these words of wisdom. She would say, stuff like, and I'm gonna paraphrase it because she liked to cuss a little bit, but I won't do that, Benny. And she would say something like, four girls before my brother came, and she said, girls, what are you waiting for? If you are waiting, then you are not focusing. If you're waiting, where's your concentration? What are you doing? If you're waiting for your father to come out, what are you doing? You're standing there waiting because you don't want to pick the right nut or bolt. My dad was a mechanic.
Okay.
She said, stop waiting. I don't care what you pick.
Yep.
Let your fingers be your guide. That's old school. And pick something. And she trained us in that. But I have to tell you, innate somewhere in all of us is a big, fat suitcase full of fear.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ascension allows us to move beyond that big, fat suitcase of fear, doesn't it?
It does. In a way that we acknowledge the fear and work with it with tools that allow it to, you know, transform and dissolve and shift into empowerment. So that's the key, mm-hmm. too. It's not ignoring it. You know, there are some styles like transcendental that are a little more just like, oh, float past the fear and don't think about it and then it'll go away. But in my experience, I haven't found that to work. It just sits there.
Yeah, I did that in the 60s.
Yeah. And it does, you know, it brings about like nice states of peace, and that's fine. But the real ascension work, it's seeing the fears. It's seeing the heavy parts of us, the shadow parts of us, the parts that, you know, are a little bit challenging to maybe look at. But, you know, it's done with compassion. It's done with ideally, you know, the skill of saying, okay, let's work through this. What did I learn there? How can I bring love and light and healing to it? And like you said, some people are able to do that on their own, but it's tough because most people, our brains, I believe, are very wired to avoid fear. And so it's even sitting in meditation on your own and saying, okay, I'm going to start to try to meditate on my fears and release them. A lot of people's brains won't even look at the fears, really. And that's where having a good guide comes in to, you know, to show you where you might be avoiding some of that.
And I think that's what we're talking about. I mean, certainly you talked earlier, for those of you just tuning in, Kelly Kay joining me here today, go over to enlightenedmedicine.com. And I think William's putting that lower third up there as well, enlightenedmedicine.com, you know, sharing it on Facebook. You're going to be able to see all the different ways she's going to help you with this. What I have found is that, and this is really strange because in looking back, I mean, it's hard to look back and know, okay, so here you are, this person today. So when you look back, you are not looking back as that person. You're looking back at this person.
Right.
So when you look back, you have to really sift through, what were you really feeling? You know, what was that moment that you decided you were just going to go for it and it didn't matter, or speak up, or ask somebody out, or it doesn't matter what it is, or make a major investment. You know, how did you go about that path? Or go back to school and not have one iota of the process and then be rejected by like 35 schools. One of them put me on a wait list. And it was my first choice. And so when I look back at that today, I thought, wow, you know, I had to face every darkness in myself and yet hold on to the love and light of a vision that I have been carrying for 20 years. But does sometimes when we hold that space of ascension, when we're in it, when we know that we want to shoot for the stars, I don't know about you, but that is like finding food that has been under the couch for a year. It comes out, it crawls out, and there it is. I have always had to get help with that.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, yeah, no one wants to look at that food, right? It looks yucky. Yeah, a lot of it's been ignored for a long time in a lot of cases. And that's where, having a guide to sit with it in compassion, non-judgment. I find that, like you were talking about, the difference between the current you and the past you, it's hard sometimes not to look back and judge yourself over, you know, choices that you made that now you're like, oh, why did I do that? Or I realized I really hurt someone's feelings by that. Or maybe I should have taken that risk and I didn't. And man, I really regret that. And so some people too, it's a lot of, you know, self-judging in a very harsh way that yes, we can learn from our mistakes, but, you know, dissolving that harshness that our society really, and meeting it with compassion so that it can be seen and transmuted. Because if we're judging it and holding it in that judgment, it's very hard to transmute it.
What have you found in working with your clients, the significance, important, and power? Can I use the word power? I love the word power.
Yeah.
I actually have a show, Power Up, but I love the word power. Women don't like to use the word power. Okay, I don't know. I don't get that. But I want to talk about the power of ascension for a moment. And what the power of ascension is, you know, from your experience, I'd love for you to share some personals and maybe without disclosing names, some of the work you've done with people to help them look at their shadow. Because I'll tell you what, when I've been alone and had to look at my shadow, it was a dark hole.
Mm-hmm.
But when I've worked with either a therapist or a coach or a friend or an angel, it doesn't matter. The process got quicker,
mm-hmm.
and the outcome got better. And I considered those ascension steps. Can you share your experience about helping people look at the shadow and what you've discovered comes out at the other end?
Yeah, absolutely. It can be really intimidating, and that's why it's so nice to have a guide.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there is a woman that I worked with, for example, that had an ex-husband who really used to, verbally abuse her, and it wasn't physical, but it was verbal and it was real, and it was emotionally very challenging for her. And even coming out of that relationship, it stuck with her, and it carried forward as a fear that it was making it difficult for her current relationship to be successful. And what's hard about doing that work on your own is she would have very real physiological responses when she would think of him, because of the impact he left on her, of feeling like she couldn't speak up and share her actual feelings or thoughts. And her body, she would cry, she would shake, she would get all the PTSD kind of physiological responses. So that is hard to do by yourself, and when you're sitting though in an energy space where it's like, okay, we're going to breathe through this, let's bring in some energy to help transmute that fear in your body that is activating right now. Okay, let's help that calm down. Okay, good, we've got that. Let's look at that energy a little more indirectly through shamanic journey, for example. You can interact with that energy in a way that it comes to you in animal form. It comes to you in a symbolic, metaphorical form that you can work with. It's not as intimidating as her having to, picture his face, for example, right? That would be too frightening for her. And so when you work through metaphor and through a shamanic journey where your subconscious is showing you, this is how the energy is sitting in you from this person, from those experiences for all of those years, then we can start to work with that image energetically, and we can start to transmute it, and we can start to, pull out the brambly weeds if that's how it's appearing in the subconscious, or if it's appearing that, as a lion that was trying to roar and intimidate her, that we can start to shamanically say, okay, lion, I'm not afraid of you anymore. We can shrink the lion into a little kitty that's not so intimidating. So there's a lot of tools that allow the energy reactions, the physiological reactions, the emotional reactions to start to downplay to a point that eventually that person or that situation or whatever it is we're trying to clear is not so overwhelming. Because, in her case, it was completely overwhelming. It immobilized her. She didn't know what to do or how to look at it on her own. And I understand,
Well, where would we learn that? I wish I had crystal ball. Right? I wish I had a crystal ball, but we don't. We do have intuition. And intuition, as you and I have talked about before on your show, is we talk about intuition and we talk about transmutation and how sometimes we have to be guided by something within us, right? I'm not saying you don't go to school and you read the books and you learn how to be a surgeon before you cut somebody open, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that when you get that moment and you have all of your knowledge and your wisdom, all of your mentors in your head, all of your training in your head, that last moment of action you take will be such a combination of energy of all of that. And that confidence will show up. I want to take a short break because when we come back, I want to talk about why this transmutation of energy is key to spiritual ascension, but why is spiritual ascension essential to the new energy in the world today? And it is a new energy. How do we find out about you, Kelly Kay? Let's give people information before we go to break. How do they contact you and tell them where they can find this upcoming course?
Absolutely. My website is enlightenmedicine.com. You can learn more about the New Paradigm program itself, the New Paradigm Multidimensional Transformation. There's a 2-day course. There's a 4-day course and really in-depth energy work, ascension work. It's fabulous. You can email me, kelly@enlightenmedicine.com, if you want more detailed information about that or have questions. You can also call me at 773-682-7124. And I do have a short waiting list right now for one-on-one sessions, but usually I can get people in within a couple weeks. So not too bad of a waiting list, and I would love to work with you directly if that calls to you.
I love that. And when we come back, here we go. We're going to talk about, this is the language we use, the shamanic journey. But when you hear Kelly Kay talk about it, what you're going to hear about is opportunities, amazing ways, transmutation of our shadow begins almost immediately. We'll talk about what that structure is like. And maybe she and I can compare a few notes on how did my first vision quest, how did it turn everything in my life upside down? I mean everything. Everything. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with Kelly Kay.
Jane Mack, and I'd love to tell you about the latest technology of the Volara Company. I've been using the Volara Company equipment, the Air Machine, since 1992, and I have found them to be totally successful in killing mold, mildew, and keeping your house fresh and clean. If you'd like more information on that, you can look at MaryJaneMack.com or call our office at 888-777-4232.
Tune into the Dr. Diane Show, where we explore revolutionary expansion of mind, body, and soul every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. I bring over 20 years of expertise as a mindset warrior, perspective shifter, and unshakable optimist dedicated to helping you reach your wildest dreams in business, health, performance, and relationships. Join the discussion on the show. Learn more about me, Dr. Diane, and receive a free digital copy of my magazine at naturalnutmeg.com.
There isn't a magic pill to creating your healthy lifestyle, yet it doesn't have to be hard or feel impossible. Health works from the inside out, connecting both your body and your mind. Georgette LePage lives and breathes what she teaches, so allow her to be living proof of what can work for you. Connect with her now for a free 30-minute discovery session to see what results you are looking for and how she can help you get them. Visit GeorgetteLePage.com.
Tune in to Awaken Your Magic Within, reveal unconscious systems to discover your unstoppable freedom power. Join me, Tracy Lynn Wallace, on TransformationTalkRadio.com the first Tuesday of each month, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, to gain insight, direction, and tools to uncover limiting beliefs. Get ready to step into your unstoppable power to discover and uncover your magic within.
Hi, I'm Coach Martez.
And I'm licensed therapist with Adrena Lathan.
We want to invite you to join us on the Coach Martez and Adrena Lathan Show, where we discuss understanding love, accepting truth, and changing your perspective.
Relationships are the currency to life, and so many couples find themselves broke in their relationships. We want you to join us for a lively discussion and practical tips and insights on how to turn things around and gain the merit for life mindset.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to a great show with Kelly Kay, Transmutation Time with Kelly Kay. I love this. Energetic alchemy for an amazing life. Sidebar, when Stevie Nicks did that concert thing, documentary she did on one of the cable channels, this is what she talked about. She talked about the energetic alchemy of her music. And this particular concert was about all of the songs she wrote that never made it on vinyl or never made it. And so this is what we're talking about today. Kelly Kay can be found if you want to really connect with her. She said she can get you in the one-on-one sessions. I know you all are feeling like you need it because you're like me, right? EnlightenMedicine.com. Give her a call. Check it out. Also, she has, I think, a couple seats open in her May 14th, May 15th, right? Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, this is one of these things that we're going to talk about right now. New paradigm, multidimensional, transformational workshop. Couple of spots left. I got to get to this journey, the shamanic journey part. Now, we're calling it shamanic journey. It is called many things by many spiritual practices, whether it's vision questing, whether it's native, you know, traveling, energetic traveling, visioning.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the power of what you call shamanic journey and why it's one of the most efficient, effective, and powerful ways to transmute our shadow.
Yes, I love them. I love doing them myself. I love guiding other people through them because, you know, when you're using the word power, to me, I always think of empowerment, which has, of course, the word power right in it, and it's owning our own power. That's empowerment. And to me, shamanic journeys they're so empowering because you are participating in your own learning about yourself, in your own healing yourself. And not to say that there's anything wrong with sometimes getting a reading or, you know, doing tarot and having other people share with you what they're sensing for you. And, you know, we talked over break about having your chart done astrologically and all that kind of stuff. And you can certainly learn about yourself that way. But there's something really beautiful about doing a journey where mm-hmm. you're seeing things, you're feeling things, you're sensing things about yourself that really, I feel like it creates like a wow moment in people, you know, and they know it's real when they're experiencing it, they're seeing it. It's different than, you know, you can kind of hear someone else say, oh, yeah, I feel like you might have this or this trait, and you kind of might go, yeah, I don't know, we'll see. But when you are in a shamanic journey, you are the one seeing it and feeling it. And I love those moments where, like, I'm guiding someone through a journey and I say, like, wow, this is interesting. I just saw, like, an owl kind of, you know, fly and land next to you. And the person will say, that's so crazy. Like, I saw an owl, too. I mean, these things, they can't be coincidences. There is some energetic connection with spirit, with me as the shamanic guide, with the person experiencing the journey. We are opening up a field where spirit can come through. It's almost like dream communication, except you're conscious. It's like lucid dreaming, so you get to remember the dream. You get to be in control of the dream, so to speak. But it really is an energetic gateway where spirit can come in and show you, okay, this is who you really are. This is what you have forgotten about yourself. This is what you've been through that you may have suppressed because it was too difficult to see at the moment. And when you see it and then you're given the tools to transmute it and to let things go, you know that you're doing it because you're seeing it happen in front of your eyes. You're feeling it. You know, a lot of people, they cry or they feel just so emotionally different by the end of it. You know it's real when you go through a process like that. And I know you've experienced it too, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to describe in a short show like this what that personal experience is like. But, you know, what you presented really is a great way to really open the door. I know that this has happened to me several times in my life. I know that they haven't looked the same. They've been different.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that they were shamanic in nature at so many levels. And, you know, when I came back from my first vision quest, and it was in 1997, I was still in school, but I was also consulting, and I was sent on this vision quest to actually steal the Sedona Cahill's ideas and bring them back to my boss. That's what he sent me. Now, you and I know that I would never go do that. I mean, it would never be. But I didn't turn it down. And when I came back and people saw me eaten by every insect on the planet, right? It took me a week to get the dirt off. But I wasn't the same.
Mm-hmm.
They could see it. Some of my friends worried, but my closest friends like Linda did not. The only thing I could do was read from my journal. And people will ask us, how profound are the changes? You know, how do you know
right.
that things will work out in a much better way?
for you.
And that's what I love about the journey is the clear difference in people afterwards. Like you said, there is a shift in perspective. I think that's the biggest thing that comes out of a really good journey. And, you know, what you went through being out there in nature, and that is how some people do it, that can be a really profound experience. Or it can be in the comfort of your own home,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Where you just go into that, you know, and I help guide people into that meditative state. And people, you know, will tell me, oh my gosh, I had my first contact that, you know, with my guides or angels for the first time in my life. That profoundly shifts people where it's like, oh, this is real. I think that's one of the biggest things that comes out of journeys is people saying, oh my gosh, I really I was a little skeptical, or, you know, I've always wanted to feel the presence of angels, but I didn't know if I was just making it up in my own mind. After a journey, people have spiritual experiences that are so real that their whole perspective on reality can change. I mean, what's more profound than that?
Yeah, and you're right about it. I mean, that happened to be a very rare opportunity for somebody like me to participate in. But you see, I know spirit is really smarter than a fifth grader. And so I know that for somebody like me who needed to get from where they were to today, something had to happen profoundly. And what a beautiful way to get it from somebody that was trying to steal somebody else's work. Hello. but we don't need to do that. You know, we are at a place now where people can work with you. They can work. They can get connected in a way that helps them connect.
Yeah.
And that's so important.
Sorry. Yeah. And that's part of, to me, the energies, like you said, there is new energies on the planet every year. It's raising in vibration, and that's making the veil thinner.
Mm-hmm.
People are having, you know, more experiences. Even people that label themselves as very practical and very grounded, they are having experiences that are making them pause and say, wait, what's really, you know, happening? Are there different layers of reality that maybe I wasn't aware of before? And once they have that opening, you know, most people want to know more. They want to explore further. And to me, this kind of, you know, the shamanic journey, the energy work, the workshops, it's all part of understanding those other dimensional aspects of reality. They are real, even though we can't always see them and feel them around us. But when we go into those meditative states or into that journey, it's a reminder that our soul is so much vaster, our reality is so much vaster than what we can always see. And to feel it, to know it, to integrate it, we do start to ascend. We start to become more multidimensional and aware of these different layers in a way that it is practical, and it's not just floating off in the clouds all the time. And, you know, we apply that to our everyday life. In my opinion, that's what it's for, is to be applied to our everyday life so that we are more centered when we're, like I said earlier, when you meet challenge, it helps you be more centered because you have a bigger perspective on what might be really happening and why, instead of just going into fear and panic mode, which is the brain's, you know, typical response to a challenge or a stressor.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, let's see the bigger picture here. A shamanic journey transmutation helps us to be able to do that with more ease. And it takes practice, and, you know, that's what it works about.
It does. But let me ask you a question related to this. And I know in a few minutes you are going to take us on a oneness activation and blessing. But I want to say this one thing, which I didn't expect. We have this thing where, have you ever walked into a therapy session, your first one, then you're finished, you feel so much better, and you say, you know, thank you, I think we're done. And the therapist looks at you like, okay, we're done for today. And you said, no, I think we're done. And you walk out really thinking you're done, and 24 hours later, it's like the walls come in, right? Because it doesn't shut you down. It's not done. It opens you up. And what I find with what we're talking about today, it was a beginning for me. It was a beginning. And it actually didn't start with that vision quest. It started even earlier than that. But there are these beginnings. I want to ask you this. Once I started down this path, there was no going back. Now, I didn't have to do a Vision Plus every 24 hours.
Right.
But something opened up that wanted to call me to learn more, to do more. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. And that's, to me, that happens to a lot of people. Some people do have a profound experience, and then they kind of slide back into the habits of their day-to-day life. And so, to me, that is where setting aside some time to do things consistently, even if it's once a month, you know, or something that keeps kind of reminding you, oh, yeah, this other reality is here, too. And then there's other people, you know, like you, that sometimes it's just an instant, like, oh, wow, I am going to carry this with me forever, right? Yeah. And that's where each journey is different. Each people mm-hmm. take, you know, each person takes away something different from that experience. Mm-hmm. I do find the live workshops, there's something about that. Where a lot
something
of people,
about them.
Yeah, they leave and they are, you know, they never forget it. They know that they are changed in a way that they can't even always put into words. But it is kind of one of those, like, no going back moments, you know, where it's like, I can't go back and live my life the way I was when I was a little more unaware. And now that I'm more aware, okay, I think I might have to make some changes, and some of them might be a little scary in order to live in alignment with who I really am in an authentic way. And that, to me, is the energies that are coming into the planet now. It's authenticity. You know, it's about stuff coming up to the surface, and you see it even on a society. It's harder to hide the shadow anymore. It's all, you know, there's so many venues for communication, and stuff is coming up, and sometimes it is unpleasant to see the things that are coming up. But if we can look at that on a personal level, and I believe that collectively we are trying to clear out a lot of the darkness that's been in humanity so that we can operate in a higher level on a society level. And that is moving towards unity consciousness. That's moving towards the oneness. You know, that's why I wanted to offer a oneness blessing, because what oneness reminds us is that we all are sparks of creation in some way. And even though there's challenges within that, and some people may have lost their connection a little bit to that spark and are, you know, seem to be on a path that we don't understand, there is an energy behind all of creation that I believe wants to support us, wants to uplift us, wants to help us ascend, but then it's our piece to do the work, to sit with the transmutation energies, to get ourselves as clear as possible. And I also believe that that is the best way that we change the world for the better. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a cause and going out and trying to live, you know, what you feel called to do, but it starts within you. And if you haven't done a lot of that work, it's very hard to help other people.
It's extremely hard. And, you know, you bring me to a point, and I would love for you to do the blessing, too. But I've had so many great mentors, and Sedonia would say to me all the time, you know, Pat, you cannot take a person to a place you haven't gone before. And I would look at my life, and I would think, where haven't I gone before? Well, I had never really lost control of my body. I had always had it. I mean, I had a rough life, but I could always count on my body to play sports, to be there for me. Whatever it is that I needed to get done, my body was there to do the work, until in 2004 it was not.
Mm.
And then I realized what Sedonia was saying. There's a level of humility that you absorb, the energy of humility, the humbling of humility, especially around the body. That when you realize how vulnerable of a body we have and how others struggle with that, it cuts off your judgmental perspective on what you think others should or shouldn't do.
Absolutely. That, to me, that's the importance of the shadow work. Not even just in the body, but in actions, in, you know, emotional responses. When we really honestly do our own shadow work, and we can be authentic enough to say, yes, I sometimes have been the one that have hurt other people, whether intentionally or unintentionally. I was the one acting from a place of selfishness or ignorance or whatever it is. We dissolve ideally that judgmental pattern in others as well. When we own it and we learn forgiveness, we learn compassion for the self, we learn to see ourselves through the eyes of Source, And then that naturally extends to others as well, which creates a much more compassionate society, which, I believe we're moving towards.
Yeah. Well, I'm really thrilled you're going to do a blessing for us today. Is this a good time for us to do it?
Perfect. Yeah, it doesn't take very long, just a few minutes. So, again, you know, if you're driving or something, please pause and do this where you're at home and you can be comfortable and you can relax. And I'd like to just set the intention that this happens for your highest good, in accordance with your soul and with divine will. And I'm going to bring in the energy of oneness, unity, consciousness. And I want to be clear that what this means, it doesn't mean that we're all have to be identical and that we all have to, you know, follow some, you know, hive mind, same way of thinking. That's not what this oneness energy is. We are all unique snowflakes. We all have our own unique energy. And what we bring to the world is going to look a little bit different. One of my great teachers says, we all have our own puzzle piece. And I think that's exactly the perfect way of putting it. Our piece might have a little bit of a different shape, different color on it, different part of the picture. And yet, when it all comes together, we are part of this really beautiful puzzle of creation. And when you can feel your connectedness to the entire puzzle, to the entire creation energy, one, it's very comforting. There's a lot of people that have felt isolated over the past couple years. There's a lot of people that start to spiritually grow and feel like they no longer relate to their friends or family the same way. Let yourself energetically extend into the different layers of creation with a recognition that you are not separate from it. You are a droplet in the ocean. You still get to be an individual drop, and you get to feel the energy of the ocean, the waves of the ocean, that creation is so much vaster than we can even imagine. And that there's a beauty in that, there's a trust in that, and there's a trust that there is a divine, I don't really like to use the word plan, but there's a divine flow. And if we allow ourselves to be part of that divine flow, the currents of the ocean, if you will, life becomes much simpler. And there is a surrendering process with that, and it can be scary to really let yourself extend out into that ocean, into that divine flow, because it can start to feel like, oh, well, then who am I? Will I lose myself? Will I lose my identity within that vast energy of the ocean? And I find that people, they don't. You actually become much more secure in who you are because you feel the support of that whole ocean of energy around you and within you, and you feel that it's made of love, and you feel that it wants to support you, and it wants to support all life. And allow yourself to energetically connect to that support, knowing that you're not alone, that there is divine love and divine light accessible to all of us at all times. Even if your life feels challenging right now or you're getting hit with unexpected things, there is this energy that you can call upon to nourish you, to support you, to remind you that we are not as separate as we think we are. And that behind, I believe, behind everything in creation, there's an energy of love, of kind of a bliss of being that's hard to put into words. And if we can feel that and connect to that and just take a moment and kind of breathe it in, let it go into your heart chakra. And when we do this, when we feel this, we naturally want to be kind to others. We naturally are more compassionate, less judgmental, less harsh with others, because we see them as reflections of the one energy that is behind everything. So allow yourself to meditate on that and call on that blessing anytime that you feel that you need it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so very, very much. Thank you for so beautifully gathering up this transmutation energy to not just help us understand what's going on, but help us know that this is just part of our transformational process. You know, it is a natural element. It's natural in the sky. We see it all the time. You know, we see how water can transmute to mist. I mean, there's so many things that remind us of the potentiality and power of that. And this is an energy that becomes a guidepost for pretty much anything we desire in life, isn't it?
It is. And what I love about it is it makes so many possibilities open up. And one thing that I hear a lot from people is a feeling of, you know, being stuck, or that trap of, oh, I'm always going to feel this way, or I'm always going to have this problem. And transmutation comes in and reminds us it doesn't have to stay that way. And anything can change. Whatever it is that you feel like is challenging, or, you know, even people that they've done therapy for 20 years and they've kind of given up and saying, ah, oh, no, it's just how I am at this point. I have seen people become so changed and transformed through this work. It really is incredible. And so to me, it carries an energy of hope, and that things are all, there's always a possibility to continue to grow and to become, you know, closer to that higher self, soul level that we are. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful gift. And it's a gift to, I believe, again, be alive right now in these times where the energies just keep making it, keep pushing us to see more and more of ourselves. So why not, you know, take advantage of that and really dedicate your spare time to your own soul development. It's all we get to take with us at the end anyway. So,
yeah, yep. It is. I mean, it is. And, you know, how often have you seen laughter transmute sadness?
Mm-hmm.
So obvious. Kelly Kay, thank you so much. Please get your website again. Let folks know how they can call you, too.
Wonderful. Yes, it's enlightenmedicine.com. Some people put enlightened, but it's a verb, so it's enlightenmedicine.com. And then, yeah, you're welcome to call my business number, 773-682-7124. Leave a voicemail. I don't always get a chance to answer because if I'm in a session, of course, I'm not going to answer the phone. But feel free to leave a voicemail. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. And I would love to work with you if this calls to you. Thank you for listening to Kelly Kay and Dr. Pat on Transmutation Time, energetic alchemy for an amazing life. Showing up to life in a healed, present way is the best gift we can give ourselves. Healing creates smoother family dynamics, better professional opportunities, and an easier time in romantic relationships. So, what are we waiting for? Learn more about Kelly and what she does by visiting enlightenmedicine.com. Don't forget to tune in next time on TransformationTalkRadio.com to turn your trust.